everybody, and welcome to the 28th episode of the Jambase Podcast. I'm Scott Bernstein, and joining me today is my co-host, David Onigman. Hi, Davo. How has 2019 started for you?
2019 is great thus far, Scotty. I just got back after a great trip to Boston and New York for 2 days where I saw you. Back in the swing of things here at Jambase.
Excellent. And we begin today with the rundown, featuring a discussion of recent news topics. Then we'll hear guitarist William Tyler chat musical mentors with Jambase's Andy Kahn. Stay tuned for the William Tyler segment, but for now, let's get into the rundown. There's lots to discuss when it comes to Phish, as the band announced the 26-date summer tour. Phish kicks off the run with two nights in St. Louis on June 11th and 12th, and then heads to Bonnaroo for a total of 3 sets. It's then off to Toronto, Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio, and Charlotte for 1 night apiece in each city. The tour continues with a pair of 2-night stands at Meriwether Post Pavilion in Columbia, Maryland, and at Darling's Waterfront Pavilion in Bangor, Maine. And then there's 3 shows in Camden to end June. July starts for Phish with 2 nights at SPAC on the 2nd and 3rd of July, and then the band's return to Fenway Park in Boston on July 5th and 6th. Next comes Phish's debut at Mohegan Sun Arena on July 9th and 10th, and 3 nights at Alpine Valley July 12th through the 14th. The tour ends with the group's traditional Labor Day weekend run at Dick's Sporting Goods Park in Denver. It's an exciting time for fans, especially after their recently completed New Year's run at Madison Square Garden in New York City. I had the pleasure of attending all 4 nights, while David joined me on the 30th and 31st. It's been well over a week since the run ended, and I'm still in a state of post-run bliss, pun intended. I was so impressed with the Phish shows in terms of how they played and what they played. It was a really good sign when they came out of the gates with We Are Come to Outlive Our Brains, one of 9 songs they'd play from the Kasvat Vox set over the course of the run. Phish seems to be in a really good place, and you know, all 4 members were smiling so much over all 4 nights, and a happy Phish leads to happy Phish fans. For me, the 29th and 30th were my favorite shows of the run, and I'd go so far as to say easily both fit into my top 25 of the 290 that I've seen. They were just on fire. Dave, what elements were at play that helped make the run so special?
Well, yeah, I mean, those middle two that you talked about, I talk a lot about Phishnet ratings and the data you can cull from there. Those middle two right now are, I think, both in the top 15 of all Phish shows, period, not just those that Scotty B has attended. Now people can talk about recency bias and all that kind of stuff on there, but like, even if that data is a bit noisy, what's very clear is that those two middle shows are pretty indisputable as like top Phish shows of all time, and the run in general, I think, benefited strongly from the Kasvat Voxed tunes making their way into the repertoire, getting taken out for a little bit more of a ride, and the band probably just feeling a bit more comfortable playing them. You know, Halloween always just like the band always just has this kind of nervous energy about them. They have been working for so long on working on those tunes, or actually maybe not that long. They shared that it was really somewhat last minute, but they were working very intently on those tunes only to get to play them once and then not play shows again for, 2 months. So it was very clear that they were eager to play those songs again that they had spent so much time working up. So I think there was an energy that came from those tunes that helped permeate the run, and really just like an injection of 9 new songs really just stretches the Phish catalog out so much more. There's a lot of big epic Phish songs that did not get played during the 4-night run because their slots were taken by these brand new tunes into the repertoire, which is always welcome. It always makes me think of one of those lines Trey used when he broke up Phish in 2004, that they didn't want to become a nostalgia act. Well, here they are in 2018, not playing tons of songs that would be considered their greatest hits and largest, you know, big meaty tunes in exchange for playing nine new tunes or, you know, Norwegian covers that they discovered to inject into the repertoire, you know, here 14 years after they broke up. So I think that had a lot to do with it. I think the playing was continues to be very inspired. As I've talked about previously on the podcast, I think sort of the top tier jams of Phish in 2017 and 2018 can compete right up there with the top tier jams of the heydays of the late 90s or those 94, 95 type jams. I think they, you know, continue to progress as players and listeners, and sort of the creme de la creme of what they can churn out these days in the middle of a tweezer jam can still rival that of any any other era of when, you know, they were playing a tweezer jam. And then I think Trey gave us all a interesting preview of what was on his mind, like song selection wise, throughout his solo tour that preceded this. Not only was he leaning heavily, not heavily, but like making sure he sprinkled in those Kasvat Vox tunes on his solo tour. Two of those biggest surprises we saw on the 30th, Glide 2's first performance since 1995 and the first ever Phish performance of Bliss were both also previewed on Trey's solo tour, which is just like, you know, reason number 300 why to really get on board and enjoy all things Trey solo. Not only is it great as its own show and he's a great storyteller, but it has also been a catalyst for him to remember some of these tunes that had gone by the wayside, and it led to Glide 2 and Bliss making their way into the set list on the 30th, if not for Hey Scotty B's tweet that led to Glide 2's inclusion, or tweets, I should say, plural. You have a number of them going back a number of years telling them to do Mike's Glide 2. but Trey's solo tour led the way, you know, for some of this stuff. And, you know, that show on the 29th, as you know, to go back to the Fishnet ratings here, which I tend to dwell on because I just find them interesting. But that show currently is the second Phish show, top rated Phish show of all time, behind
Big Cypress.
And Phish diehards listening to this podcast can debate amongst themselves if that is overrated or has recency bias or whatever. But it is still hanging on to that number two slot. And one thing that stuck out to me about this show that sort of maybe I haven't seen mentioned on Twitter or anything yet is that it is actually pretty short. You know, the song, sorry, I'm pulling up my actual live Phish app here. Give me a second to vamp. Yeah, it is 2 hours and 28 minutes, where the average Phish show these days is closer to 3 hours. And I remember this from back when, before we had livefish.com and all this stuff. And I remember thinking back in the late 90s that a lot of the quote unquote best Phish shows could fit on two CDs instead of three CDs. And like Dayton 97 is 2 hours and 19 minutes, and Hampton 97, both nights there are under 2.5 hours total. Whereas like that third show that they released with Hampton 97, Winston-Salem 97, which is like on the official release but never gets the accolades that Hampton 97 does, is like 3 hours and 10 minutes. So like, there's a part of me that wonders, like, in this alternate universe, 12/29/2018 right now is hanging on to the Fishnet top two show of all time, because it, you know, partially in part, you know, the first set smoked, the second set also like never had like that ballad let up, and also was pretty short. You know, it goes Carini, Tweezer, Death Don't Hurt Very Long, Tweezer, No Quarter, 2001, First Tube. And like, I wonder, like, the types of people that rank shows on Fishnet, or like that type of like, holy shit, that was an all-timer feeling that you get walking out of an arena. Like, part of me wonders, like, if it had actually gone Tweezer, Death Don't Hurt Very Long, Tweezer, No Quarter, Limb by Limb, Shade, 2001, First Tube, if this show actually would be more like on the top 20 shows on Fishnet, and if part of what like props these shows up to being all-timers is that the shows are a little shorter, and in them being a little shorter, there's less of a breather. Like, No Quarter is the breather in this set, which is not really much of a breather. So like, it's like this weird thing in my head where like, huh, if they had actually done this exact same music, but the show was 2 hours and 50 minutes long, which is more their like average these days, and included a couple more songs, I think we wouldn't be here talking about it being the second best show of all time. We'd be talking about it being a top 25 of all time. It's just this like funny thing where sometimes more music doesn't equal like epic status of best show of all time. And like, if Fish, and this is a joke, if Fish was trying to crank out shows that made it to the Fishnet top 10, like, is one of the things you're supposed to do, play for 2 hours and 20 minutes, not 3 hours, you know? They don't like to do that these days. They like to play really long shows. But anyway, that's my manifesto about the correlation between shorter second sets and shorter shows and more well received shows by the Fish diehard, Fish Twitter, Fishnet rankers among us.
That's a great point. And I mean, I love the phrase all killer, no filler. And there were many sets and entire nights, the 29th, there was just no let up. I mean, even a song like 46 Days that could be standard, that was far from a standard version. It was heavily exploratory and it wasn't that long, but it was deep and a really cool drop into cities. And of course, Wolfman's Brother, it had parts of Party Time in it. Whether it makes your set list or not is up for debate. As for now, Fishnet does have it as Wolfman's Brother into Party Time, into Wolfman's Brother.
But that was just one of... This was much debate, right? There was a lot of back and forth on this.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think a few days ago, they finally relented, the Fishnet team, and put in Party Time.
It's so funny. There's another one a couple of years ago that was hard to decide if it was like quoting Party Time or not. The reason it's so hard when it is Party Time is because it literally only has two words. If Party Time actually was a song that had 20 words and you just said Party Time, it'd probably be an easier call to not put it on there. But yeah, I understood both sides of that argument. It really didn't have the music of Party Time, like the drum beat and the lick. The lick was kind of there. I understood both sides of that and enjoyed watching all of you Fish diehards duke this out on Twitter. It was comical.
No doubt. And I just thought the set lists were just really well crafted. And it was interesting hearing Ask Trey on Sirius XM's Fish Radio beforehand, and to hear Trey talk about his pre-show day rituals and how he would just go over the song list intently a number of times before coming up with a song list that they'd base the evening off of. And that method worked really well. And I really, you know, and one thing that I noted about the 29th and 30th is they came out of the gate so hot. Both Buried Alive and Alumni Blues were so well played and seemed longer than usual and really set the tone for what turned out to be incredible nights. And between the Wolfman's Party Time fun and Weekapa seemingly everywhere towards the end of the first set on the 30th, They really were just firing on all cylinders, and makes me very excited for what's ahead. Now that there's 26 shows coming up this summer, let alone we've got the Mexico shows next month. So, as I said, real exciting time to be a Phish fan. And I left that run so impressed. And I just, there are even moments that I've gone back and listened to that really blew my mind on second listen that at the time didn't hit me as hard. Like the Down With Disease jam from New Year's Eve was long and hit some really cool places that they don't usually go toward. Split Open and Melt was absolutely terrifying in the best way possible on the 30th. And it's really a golden age for that song right now. And so it's as I said, it's really a great time to be a fan.
The 30th in particular, I think one of the more impressive things about the show was that it came the day after the 29th. You know, like...
That's a great point.
Especially having missed the 29th, I sort of was like mentally preparing myself. I was like, well, Devo, you missed the best show of the run by not going, but you'll get the next two, and hopefully they're pretty good. And then the 30th is like pretty up there as far as like, you know, being a top-notch Phish show with the 29th as well. So it was like, you know, if you were a betting man after the 29th, you'd be like, probably not going to be that good again this run. And then the 30th was neck and neck right there with it as far as a all-time Phish show.
Exactly. Great times, and can't wait to see what lies ahead.
Yep. All right. Well, I think that'll wrap our discussion of all things Phish, and that's all we're going to talk about. No, I'm just kidding. Phish wasn't the only band in our scene that had a big end to 2018. Widespread Panic wrapped the year with three sold-out shows at the Fox Theater in Atlanta. Panic had a number of surprises in store right from the start as they opened on the 29th with Vacation for the first time ever. Night one also included a massive Phish water sequence in the first set and a driving song sequence that spanned nearly all of the second set. Then the sextet both opened and closed with Porch Song. On the 30th, Panic went with the slow version to open and the standard take to end an encore that also featured Picking Up the Pieces and Proven Ground. New Year's Eve also had plenty of memorable moments, including a tribute to the late Colonel Bruce Hampton in the form of I'm So Glad, the return of Michael Hauser's The Waker for the first time since the guitarist's death in 2002, and the Widespread Panic debut of Bastards in the Bubbles from their Brute Side project with Vic Chestnut. Scotty, how did the String Cheese incident finish 2018?
Well, the String Cheese incident played Broomfield's First Bank Center in their home state of Colorado on December 28th, 29th, and 31st. And the run marked the start of the band's 25th anniversary celebration. Cheese was joined by a number of guests during the first two nights. Bluegrass greats Sam Bush and Daryl Anger sat in for most of the first set on the 28th, as well as the encore. And highlights from that included a Wild Boo Boo's Picnic segment that included multiple vamps on Take the Money and Run by Steve Miller Band, and plenty of other songs in there as well. SCI went a more funky route on the 29th, with help from Robert Randolph, Ivan Neville, Ian Neville, and Tony Hall. On that night, Cheese threw in guest spots throughout the evening, including a transcendent version of Voodoo Child featuring Robert Randolph in the second set, and the String Cheese Incident debut cover of Funkadelic's Red Hot Mama with all four guests as the encore. Sextet went at it alone for their three-set New Year's Eve show. Cheese dusted off a cover of Rush's Tom Sawyer for the first time since 2015 to end their first set, and debuted the SoundLab track Into the Blue to kick off the second set. Then they worked colliding into a New Year's Eve countdown as part of the third set. SCI provided a spectacle to end 2018 and start 2019 as they employed aerialists and dancers to accompany the big balloon drop. I also loved Bill Nursey's speech that began the third set. Nursey was emotional and on the verge of tearing up as he talked about the path that led the band to 25 years together. It was rather frank in discussing the ups and downs along the way. I also got a little misty by the time they started the group Hoot as I watched the video of that segment. Dave, how did Umphrey's New Year's run go?
Umphrey's, my heart is still with you on New Year's, even if I'm at a Phish show. I've seen more Umphrey's New Year's than Phish, but not this year. Umphrey's McGee ended the year with four nights at the Tabernacle in Atlanta. The band focused on a career-spanning set of originals on the 28th with a cover of Pink Floyd's Time thrown in for good measure. Then the 29th was highlighted by a 20-minute 2x2 in the first set and a run of The Floor, Wappy Sprayberry, and Remind Me that took up nearly 45 minutes to start set two. In addition, they busted out covers of Band on the Run by Wings for the first time since 2011 and Rush's YYZ for the first time since 2015. The 30th featured versions of Utopian Fur and All in Time that each extended beyond the 20-minute mark. Saxophonist Jeff Coffin added to Made to Measure towards the end of the first set and stuck around to join Umphrey's and guitarist Corey Wong on a debut cover of Jamiroquai's Virtual Insanity to close the frame. Later in the night, frequent Wolfpack collaborator Antoine Stanley emerged to help the band dust off the long-lost mashup Can't Rock My Dream Face. Coffin was also on hand on New Year's Eve as part of Mad Dog and His Filthy Little Secrets horn section. The horns added to a number of songs in the second and third sets, including the first River People since 2013, a debut cover of Little Feat's Fat Man in the Bathtub, the return of It's About That Time after 151 shows, and the attachments that led into 2019, and their cover of Auld Lang Syne that always sounds like the Saturday Night Live closing music. The horns were also on stage for the resolution that followed, as well as the third set closing combo of Booth Love and In Excess's What You Need. A particularly cool moment took place at the start of the encore as the band faced off against the horns in what Brendan Bayless described as a challenge. The horns started by playing a segment of Glenn Miller's In the Mood, while the band returned with a bit of The Ocean by Led Zeppelin. The horns and the band went back and forth a few times, with the only clear winner being the Umphrey's fan base collected there at the show. Next up was Haji, before Umphrey's and the horns closed out the evening with a cover of Kiss's Detroit Rock City. Scotty, I hear Government Mule went to traveling for the New Year's Eve. Tell us about it.
Yes, indeed. Warren Haynes and his mates ended a three-show New Year's run with a marathon New Year's Eve performance at the Beacon Theater in New York City. The theme was All Roads Lead to the Beacon, and the entire 20-song second set, as well as the encore, featured tunes that either had titles or song lyrics discussing traveling or methods of transportation. Mule was joined by Jackie Green, Sean Pelton, Corky Lang, and Jimmy Vivino throughout the second set and encore. Fittingly, the band's own traveling tune both opened and closed the frame. There was a bevy of cover debuts included, such as The Black Crowes' Wiser Time, Casey Jones' By the Dead, Little Feat's Two Trains, Deep Purple's Highway Star, Lynyrd Skynyrd's Tuesday's Gone, and Travelin' Man by Bob Seger. Jackie had a few turns leading the Mule, as he sang lead on Ramblin' Man, Runnin' Down a Dream, and Silver Train. Finally, for our New Year's Eve wrap-up, Dave, can you tell us about the debut of The Big Swell in Hawaii?
You got it. Grateful Dead members Bob Weir and Bill Kreutzmann were joined by a handful of other musicians as The Big Swell to headline the inaugural installment of the Rising Up to Paradise event on Kauai's North Shore in Hawaii on New Year's Eve. The core band for most of the night featured Bobby, Billy, Dead & Company keyboardist Jeff Cementi, Rat Dog bassist Robin Sylvester, percussionist Wally Ingram, and guitarist Steve Kimmock. The Big Swell opened with a run of Grateful Dead classics before the stage was turned over to Billy, Bobby, Taj Mahal, Wally Ingram, and Don Was for takes on Deep Ellum Blues and I've Been All Around This World. After Taj's appearance, the core band went on to finish the first set with a full Weather Report suite. The evening's second set began with Help on the Way, followed by Slipknot, but Franklin's Tower was already off the table, having been performed in the first set. Instead, the big swell went with Scarlet Begonias. In an inventive mood, Scarlet led into a take on the Meters' Fire on the Bayou. Ah, I see what they did there. Featuring legendary bassist George Porter Jr. George also added to versions of Sugaree and Ico Ico that followed. The Big Swell's core band then reassembled for the pairing of Estimated and Eyes. Weir used his Apple Watch to gauge the countdown into 2019 as hula dancers danced on the side of the stage. The Big Swell said farewell with The Music Never Stopped and Ripple. Now that we've talked all about what happened on New Year's Eve, how about what's coming in the future? Scotty, what are some of the festival lineups that have come up since our last episode?
This is about the busiest time of year for festival lineup announcements, and I bet there will be a few that get announced between the time that we record this segment, which is on Wednesday afternoon, and the time that we publish the podcast. And one of the biggies that was revealed earlier this week was Bonnaroo. As I mentioned, Phish returns to the Roo for the first time since 2012 and will play a total of 3 sets. They'll perform what has been described as a late evening set on Friday night after Childish Gambino, and then they'll close out the festival with 2 sets on Sunday night. Post Malone headlines on Saturday, and the Lumineers top the bill with Phish on Sunday. The Avett Brothers, Brandi Carlile, The National, Trampled by Turtles, Jim James, John Prine, Courtney Barnett, and the Wood Brothers are just a handful of the other acts set to play Bonnaroo between June 13th and 16th. Meanwhile, Bottle Rock scored Neil Young in Promise of the Real, Santana, Mumford & Sons, Imagine Dragons, Pharrell, Gary Clark Jr., and dozens more to play Napa Valley Expo in Napa, California over Memorial Day weekend. If we head down the California coast, Coachella will take place over 2 weekends in April at the Empire Polo Club in Indio, with Childish Gambino, Tame Impala, and Ariana Grande as the headliners. Janelle Monáe, Weezer, Aphex Twin, Khalid, 1975, Diplo, Bass Nectar, and Mac DeMarco are among the many other acts aboard for Coachella 2019. Then there's Governor's Ball, which once again will be held on Randall's Island in New York City between May 31st and June 2nd. Florence and the Machine, Tyler the Creator, The Strokes, Lil Wayne, SZA, Nas, the 1975, Kacey Musgraves, and Louis the Child top the bill for this year's festival. Governor's Ball is the first 2019 U.S. gig confirmed for the Strokes thus far. Finally, late last month, summer camp organizers confirmed the first round of acts set to play Three Sisters Park in Chillicothe, Illinois. As usual, Humphries, McGee, and Moe will perform all 3 days. Big Gigantic, Zed Stead, George Clinton and Parliament Funkadelic, Trampled by Turtles, Chris Robinson Brotherhood, Blues Traveler, and Toots of the Maytals are just a few of the many other acts announced thus far. For more details on all these festivals and more, be sure to head to Jambase. Well, that's it for the rundown. Now, let's get to Andy's Musical Mentors interview with William Tyler.
Hey everyone, Andy here, and we'll get to my interview with William Tyler in just a minute. But before we do, let's listen to a track from his upcoming new album, Goes West. The album is being released by this episode's sponsor, Merge Records, and will be available everywhere on January 25th. Goes West was recorded by William with the help of Tucker Martin, Meg Duffy, Bill Frisell, and others. William and I discuss Goes West toward the end of our chat, which is coming up right after we play the single, Call Me When I'm Breathing Again, that you can hear now thanks to Merge Records. Thank you. So this is Andy Kahn, and I am backstage at The Independent in San Francisco with William Tyler, ahead of his show here tonight. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
So we're going to do a musical mentors segment with William, where we're going to go back in time a little bit and figure out who has influenced him and who has been part of his musical development. So let's go all the way back to the beginning. When did you first start playing guitar?
I started playing guitar kind of for real when I was about 16. I grew up in a musical family in that my dad was a songwriter, song publisher, and my grandfather on my mom's side was a pretty gifted self-taught musician who actually had learned how to read music and during the big band era and became an arranger because he figured out the arrangers made more than the band than just the guitar player. So, and I just have a lot of memories of growing up listening to him play piano when we would go visit him in Mississippi. And then just being in Nashville, I have a lot of memories of even before I had any real focus on playing music, I was interested in it. I would go with my dad to the studio when he was doing demos. And I was really fascinated with recording studios at a pretty early age. And I guess musicians, too. I mean, most of my dad's friends were musicians, and so I was around a lot of older musicians at a young age. But when I started playing guitar, I think it was not atypical from most kids where you're just I can't play sports. What's the only other way to have people have anything in common with me? Oh, I'll play music, in high school.
So what music were you listening to then at around that time? You said you grew up in a musical family and your dad's in the business. Are his music flowing through the house?
Yes, but not in a way that I think a lot of kids who I know in Nashville grew up with. My dad was a songwriter and song publisher kind of first and foremost. He was a behind the scenes guy. He played guitar. He had guitars at the house, but it wasn't he wasn't a collector of guitars. There wasn't a lot of gear there. I don't think it was the same as kids who probably grew up with touring musician dads.
Okay.
A lot of kids I know either grew up very directly with dads who were touring performers or sometimes even went out on the road with them. And I didn't have that experience, but I was interested in music at a pretty early. I was really interested in classical music when I was really little. And a part of that was because my granddad, who I just mentioned, he was a benefactor to the symphony in Jackson, Mississippi. And I remember being really little, probably 6 or 7 at the oldest. And he took me to the symphony hall and was walking me around and explaining all the instruments. And that part of my brain that's just probably obsessed with cataloging information was just oh, wow. And that sound, that thing makes that sound. And that, so I wasn't really interested. I mean, I know this sounds kind of funny, but I really wasn't interested in rock music until I was probably a teenager. Uh-huh. I was really into classical music. I was really into history. So I was really into songs of old Civil War era stuff and folk music from I guess really looking back on it kind of stuff that would be almost more in the Harry Smith kind of world, but before I knew what that stuff was.
Sure.
But yeah, so I guess there was always music around. When I was in bands in high school, I mean, I was into new wave and punk stuff mainly.
So what made you then decide ultimately that you wanted to play guitar?
I think honestly it was the most immediate form of expression in an instrument that I felt I had a goal, I wanted to be in a band, and I wasn't a very good singer. I wasn't a very good keyboard player, but I knew how to play piano.
How'd you learn to play piano?
I took lessons.
Okay. You did.
So I had a little bit of training there, but very minimal. I mean, I didn't have really what, I guess.
But just the basic,
I didn't have any sort of grade 2 hand technique.
Parents made you do it.
I don't even know if they made me, but I think they encouraged it, but it was also it was not intensive. I mean, I understood the rudiments of keyboard, but not really enough to play. And then And I was a drummer too, but I grew up across the street from this guy who was a childhood friend who I ended up being in a band with for years. And he wasn't actually like a really good drummer. And one day he came over to jam with my band and I was the drummer, and I kind of got up for one song to like sing, and he played drums. I was like, oh, this guy should just play drums because I'm not ever going to be as good as him. And I was taking guitar lessons, and I guess long story short, like, I definitely connected with it, you know? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of, it's like one of those things where I think there's certain instruments when you're a kid, because I remember like I also was trying to get into jazz band and my freshman year, and the only instrument that wasn't taken was clarinet, and I lasted about 2 weeks on that. Oh, and yeah. I was just like, yeah, do you guys need like an aux percussion guy? Because I can do that. And he was like, can you read music? I was like, yeah, a little bit. Uh-huh. Kind of like bluffed my way into it. But yeah, so I can't say that like from day one I had some sort of burning passion for the guitar, although I did have a really good teacher.
Who was that?
His name's Rob Jackson. He's an old school Nashville guy. I don't think he was ever really like a big session guy, but like he knew my dad. Mm-hmm. They were in the same circle of songwriter people, and he just had a really special ability, which any good teacher in any field has, of patience, but also an ability to make you engaged with the subject.
Okay.
And when you're trying to get somebody to learn an instrument, it's really hard. It's like a personal trainer trying to get you interested in exercise. It's like there's not a lot of reward from it immediately, you mm-hmm. know? And
the same amount of pain, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in a different way, I think, yeah, sure, you know, sure. When you're really learning your first position exercises and, you know, you don't have calluses, I mean, guitar is like a pretty unrewarding instrument. Definitely. You know? So once you get over that kind of 1 or 2 year hump, I think, which for me was pretty easy, it came, the easy stuff came naturally enough. I think I kind of slacked off on a lot of technique until much later. Which is funny because I think a lot of people I know who are guitar players my age, like, it was almost like the opposite. Like they were really into like metal or something where they were really learning how to shred like really young. And I was like, yeah, you know, I think looking back on it, mainly laziness was like, I don't really care about learning how to play scales. Like I like the Ramones. And now I'm like, yeah, wow, I really wish I'd been practicing more when I was a teenager, because it gets harder the older you get.
So how long did you take lessons before you kind of felt like you were...
It was kind of...
Were you doing it regularly? Like, were you...
I took lessons with Rob like for about 3 years.
Okay.
But funnily enough, I remember when I started bringing him... You know, he was like of the era of like, you know... I mean, he liked a few modern bands. Like he liked R.E.M. a lot. But like... And I liked R.E.M. a lot. But like... When I started bringing him stuff, like trying to learn how to play like Sex Pistols and like,
yeah,
you know, Dead Kennedys songs, he uh-huh. was kind of like, yeah, I'm not really into this anymore.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know, or something. Not, I didn't get cut off, but it was, I just, also that was honestly, I was like 18 or 19 at that point. And really not too long after that, I started playing in bands with older musicians, like out of high school. And that was just dumb luck. That had nothing to do with skill. I think it was just like being around older musicians, and they're like, well, this kid's at least knows about music that he's too young to know about, so maybe we should play music.
Are you talking about Lamb Chop?
Lamb Chop, but also before that, but same crew of dudes.
Okay.
Like same kind of scene.
Gotcha.
Because Nashville at the time, late 90s, really was like, you know, country and, you know, I guess for lack of a better term, alt country stuff. And then, like, whatever freak zone Lamb Chop kind of existed in, and, yeah. and everybody around that, which actually, looking back on it, were some really interesting people. But I kind of fell in with that group because I worked at this coffee house that a lot of those guys used to come into. Okay. And so I just got to be friends with them. And then, like, a couple of years later, I was, like, playing with them.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, Lamb Chop was another funny example that you bring that up. Like, when I was a fan of theirs. I mean, I went and saw all their shows. And Kurt, the singer in Lamb Chop, had asked me about playing with them, which totally blindsided me because I was like, well, I don't know how to play tuba, and, you know, do you want a tuba player? And he was like, no, we need a keyboard player for this tour. And I was like, and I just lied. I was like, okay, Like, I just bluffed. I was like, yeah. I didn't even own a keyboard. I was like, yeah, I can do this.
Yeah.
Next day, get on eBay, find a Farfisa organ, practice, like, hours a day learning all their songs, passably enough to, like, do that. But about a year into it, he was like, okay, you actually want to play guitar, so here's a guitar. You know, I mean, that was the transition there.
So what was the first guitar that you were playing?
That I ever played?
Yeah. Do you still have it?
It's funny because this is actually a cute story. The first guitar I ever played full-time actually was originally my mom's guitar.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom got it as a wedding anniversary present from my dad, and it was like a knockoff Fender Strat.
Uh-huh.
And so she started taking guitar lessons and then lost interest in it pretty quickly. And that was about the same time that I wanted to play guitar. So she was like, well, you can have this. And it's so funny because it's totally like, yeah, this was a kid in the mid-90s and putting bumper stickers on this guitar. And like, it's still at my parents' house. But what was my first real guitar? I sort of inherited a Tele from one of my dad's friends that was actually like a 70s Tele.
Professional grade,
yeah. And I played that for a long time in Lamb Chop, and then, you know, I mainly play acoustic now, and you know, the two main acoustics I have are both guitars that were family guitars. Like,
oh, really?
One of them, this Martin that I have that I'm with this with me mm-hmm. tonight, was a D12 that my uncle, my mom's brother, had kind of let me have, and my dad had a Gibson that he sort of kind of passed down to me at some point too. So, yeah. And then I don't know. I guess I just started kind of accumulating guitars a little bit. You know,
do you have a big collection now?
No, I don't know. I mean, yeah. What's a big collection?
Well, I mean, I don't
know. I think it depends. Yeah. I probably own like 10 guitars.
Okay. I think like for a professional musician, yeah. I think that's a right amount.
Yeah. I mean, I would, as most guitar players would probably say, I'd love to have more, but
sure.
Also deal with having less, you know.
So this is jam bass that I've got to ask, because yeah. I know that one of your guitars has a Grateful Dead Steal Your Face on it.
Oh yeah.
Right. So what is your relationship with the Grateful Dead? How did that sticker end up on that guitar?
Yeah, it's funny. Somebody I was asking me earlier, you like the Dead? I was like, dude, I've got a Steely sticker on my Telecaster, which I will be playing tonight. So honestly, I came around to the Dead. Like, when I was in high school, I kind of went to this artsy, kind of, you know, Bennington College-esque kind of private school in Nashville that, like, a lot of, like, Music Row parents sent their kids to.
Okay.
And for whatever reason, the trendy stuff was jam bands. Uh-huh. And so, for me, the Dead kind of got lumped in with all the other stuff that was going on in the 90s, which honestly, like, looking back on it, there's a lot of stuff that I was into, but a lot of the seniors at the high school who were like these hippie dudes were also kind of like jocks.
Uh-huh.
And so I weirdly sort of associated the Dead with like kind of like being bullied by these like older uh-huh. upperclassmen. So I was kind of like, yeah, I'm not into that, you know, and like never really checked it out. And then in the meantime, got really, really into like, you know, all of the 60s music and, like,
sure.
You know, all the, even some of the psych stuff like Jefferson Airplane, and has never really gotten into the Dead. And this is a really funny entry point. I got obsessed with Black Flag when I was in my early 20s, and that was kind of how I discovered the Dead.
Okay.
For real, was because they were like Greg Ginn's favorite
band. Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, okay, there's something I'm missing here or that I have overlooked.
Uh-huh.
And I just think, like, if it happens to anybody this way, and I'm a pretty OCD person, like once I'm into something, I'm all in. And there were just enough moments I had where I was like, this band's blowing my mind for a lot of different reasons, and I just want to know everything I can about it. And so I didn't really get into them into my earlier mid 20s, but yeah, I mean, I came around in a big way.
Enough to put a sticker on your guitar?
Absolutely, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just, it's a good conversation starter, or at least shows people where you stand on something. You know?
Thank you.
So I also want to ask you about this being musical mentors. And
right.
you come from a musical family with a lot of experience in the on the business side of it.
Sure.
Have you ever been approached to as like a mentor for other musicians? Like knowing that you probably have some of that knowledge, yeah, right?
That's a good question. Well, I'm 38 now. So I just think by virtue of having experience and being older, honestly being older than a lot of musicians I'm around now on a regular basis, I do tend to like get sought out for advice. I can say this pretty unequivocally, and this is just because I respect like the different aspects of what the jobs are. I've never managed anybody, but I have tour managed. I've worked at like a small record label. I've done inventory. Like I've done a lot of different aspects of the business besides writing and performing. And I just, my heart is so in that part that I just feel like I have so much respect for people who do like booking agent work and management, and even more so like the legal end and the publishing, yeah, because that's really where the money's all hidden. But it's, I could do it, but I'd almost rather have another job that had nothing to do with music and then just do what I like doing than, you know what I mean? Like,
sure, definitely.
But having said that, like, no, I'm pretty, through my dad and my family and just general experience, I have a pretty good radar for certain business things. So, if people come to me with advice about, like, record contracts or just general, like, macro issues of like, should I do this thing with this label or should I, they want me to do this, and I'm like, I feel like I can get pretty good advice, mm-hmm, you know. But yeah, it's funny, I've never thought about doing it in anything but a, you know, friendly advisory role,
right,
you know?
Right, yeah, but I, that's what I meant,
just yeah, like, yeah, yeah, no, totally,
you know, casual conversations, yeah, of like, hey, have you experienced this or
yeah,
you know, yeah, this, that, like, I'm confused about publishing, right?
Sure,
like,
yeah, yeah, no, totally, you know? And I mean, and to be fair, I think a lot of musicians, I mean, of course the landscape's completely different now and is changing rapidly, I mean, because there was legislation
just now,
this,
yeah,
week, I mean, right,
as we talk, yeah.
I do think that I and this is something, you know, I feel like my dad is like, he definitely, I don't want to say errs on the side of this, but like his business acumen and his acumen for like publishing and legal stuff is very high. I don't want to say it's ever gotten in the way of him doing more musical stuff, but it is that balance you have to have of like, you know, you need to know what's going on with your business.
Yeah.
But you don't want it to inform like any creative decisions you make if you can avoid it, you,
sure,
know, and none of us can avoid it all the time, but if you're doing kind of esoteric music, which I basically assume is what I do, like it the business does not cloud it most of the time,
sure, right,
because you know what I mean, like you're already doing something that for lack of a better term is I would say uncommercial in a traditional sense. Doesn't mean it's not accessible, it's just
a labor of love that's earning a living,
right,
through,
exactly,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
you're still earning a living, but it's still like your labor of love, you're not going to sacrifice your morals or
no
or
and for, yeah,
you're driven by the creative process,
exactly,
yes,
yeah.
So I want to ask too, how did you end up with Merge?
Merge was, I knew Merge through Lamb Chop,
uh-huh,
But oddly enough, I kind of, like when I started doing my own music, I was really cautious about reaching out to them about putting out my record. Probably because I wanted a little distance, like vibe-wise, from being associated with Lamb Chop.
Mm-hmm.
Not anything negative, just like I just wanted to do my own thing. But, you know, it was kind of funny, like I remember finally having working up the courage to like send them what I guess ended up being my second or third record, and they put it out, and they've been putting out my record since then, and it's interesting having a relationship with them that's totally apart from working with Lamb Chop or other bands, because I have known those guys in some capacity since I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like it's more kind of an extended family vibe with those guys. Like I've really have known Mac and Laura and Christina, who's the label manager now. She came on as an intern. We were the same age, so I've known a lot of those people for like the better part of 15, 16 years, you know.
That's cool.
Which is pretty cool.
And you have another record coming soon?
I've got a record. It's called Goes West. It's coming out at the end of January. Recorded in Portland with Tucker Martine.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And
that's exciting.
It's cool. It's a cool band.
Who else plays on it?
Well, my manager Brad Cook, who also manages Hiss, and
Megaphone,
of course, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he was. Yeah,
I love that.
I know. I miss Megaphone.
I love that.
That's how I opened for Megaphone. That's how I know those guys years and years ago. Anyway, Brad plays bass on it and produces it with Tucker. Meg Duffy, from Hand Habits, plays electric guitar, and Griffin Goldsmith from Dawes plays drums.
Wow, awesome.
Yeah. And then
are some players, man.
Yeah, and then there are also our buddy James Wallace, who plays keyboards with Hiss sometimes, also plays with Phil Cook's solo band. He plays piano and organ, so it's a really cool band.
Cool, man. That's awesome. Well,
yeah.
We should get you back out of here pretty soon.
I'd love that,
you gotta take the stage here pretty soon.
Yeah.
But thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me
with
us.
Yeah. And good luck with the rest of the tour.
Thank you, Annie.
Cheers.
Okay, bye.
That's it for the 28th episode of the Jam Bass Podcast. Thanks to William for chatting with us, and thanks to you for listening. This installment has been produced by Jake Alexander and features theme music from Clangin' and Bangin'. You can subscribe to the Jam Bass Podcast through your favorite podcast provider, including iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and Spotify. We appreciate any feedback, ratings, and comments, so don't hesitate to shoot us a note at podcast@jambase.com or leave a rating on your favorite podcast provider. Enjoy the start of your 2019 and be sure to go see live music.